listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Thanks for joining us for this very special show, our final Table Talk program, episode 56. It is April 23rd, 2015. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And I want to say to you, Ray, we've made it to the grand finale, haven't we?
I think we've done well, my friend.
Well, we're in our final stretch here, and the thing I thought about is the show, as the opening music was playing, oh, I'm going to miss hearing that beautiful music.
Yeah,
that's
kinda
really
got familiar.
Oh, it's so beautiful. And I just want to remind the listeners, since I mentioned it, that is by Richard Wagner, and it is Siegfried's Idol, written in honor of the birth of his son. It's not part of one of the operas. That's what we've been using for this program. And, you know, I feel almost like someone who's just completed a marathon, or at least I'm excited and thrilled to be crossing the finish line. It's not that it's been a grueling experience or anything like that. It's been most enjoyable, but I am ready to move on to other things. And this has actually been a difficult book to read and try to give the listeners sufficient background information and so that they can make sense of it. Yeah, I found it quite challenging. How about you?
I, like you, I've enjoyed the whole trip, you know, from the first page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
On and on. And yeah, you're correct. You know, some aspects of this particular study don't lend itself to easy teaching or passing on or whatever, but I think reading straight from the text, you commenting how that struck you or how you interpreted it and me, you know, I think we've traveled the road pretty well, and I'm really, really pleased, you know, that this is ending up the way it's ending up. We've just got this one page left this evening,
yeah.
But
well, let me just
I consider it one of the most powerful.
Yeah, before I get into that, let me just comment about the that I think that this book was more difficult by far than reading The International Jew. And I think because, for one thing, it wasn't written for public consumption, so it wasn't written in a very, you know, real professional way to make it easy to read and so on, and enjoyable and all that. But it was it's the private thoughts and words of Adolf Hitler within his own personal space and among his personal friends and associates. And so there are a lot of things that we had to find out what they meant and what they were and so on. And like you said, I think we were pretty successful in helping the listeners gain a great deal from this book and this reading. And that's what I mean by I think it was challenging. It certainly took more time from me than preparing for The International Jew did. So, and I'll just throw in here, since it seems to fit right at this moment, I want to thank Richard from Chicago for his very kind donation today. And I'm mentioning it here because I'm sure he's listening to this show, or he will listen to it. And just to tell you, Ray, we've got a caller on the line, but it's not a caller, it's just a listener. And I see how this is now. It's just the listening part is lit up here. So we've got somebody hanging on here listening to us, who maybe has trouble listening to Blog Talk, I don't know. But anyway, welcome to him or her, whatever. And so
let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Is that listener area code 713?
Yes, it is.
Well, wonderful,
yes.
Because
that
I had
a friend
over there. Yes, and it's in Houston. And they said they were going to try to tune in this evening, and so that's good. Maybe that's them. Houston's a big place, but
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised.
Good.
So, okay, well, welcome to Houston. Come in, Houston. Mm. All right. Well, so you're going to move on now to our reading for tonight, and that's just perfect. And I'm going to switch over to that other page with that on it. And you go ahead now, Ray. I won't interrupt you anymore. I don't have any timeline for it either. I just forgot about that part.
Okay. Okay. The last entry, the night of the 29th and 30th of November, 1944. Jesus and St. Paul. Christianity, a Jewish maneuver. Christianity and communism. National Socialism, the implacable enemy of everything Jewish. The Fuhrer says, Jesus was most certainly not a Jew. The Jews would never have handed one of their own people to the Roman courts. They would have condemned him themselves. It is quite probable that a large number of the descendants of the Roman legionaries, mostly Gauls, were living in Galilee, and Jesus was probably one of them. His mother may well have been a Jewess. Jesus fought against the materialism of his age and therefore against the Jews. Paul of Tarsus, who was originally one of the most stubborn enemies of the Christians, suddenly realized the immense possibilities of using, intelligently and for other ends, an idea which was exercising such great powers of fascination. He realized that the judicious exploitation of this idea among non-Jews would give him far greater power in the world than would the promise of material profit to the Jews themselves. It was then that the future St. Paul distorted with diabolical cunning the Christian idea. Out of this idea, which was a declaration of war on the golden calf, on the egotism and the materialism of the Jews, he created a rallying point for slaves of all kinds against the elite, the masters, and those in dominant authority. The religion fabricated by Paul of Tarsus, which was later called Christianity, is nothing but the communism of today. Bormann intervened. This is Bormann speaking. Jewish methods, he said, have never varied in their essentials. Everywhere they have stirred up the plebs against the ruling classes. Everywhere they have fostered discontent against the established power. For these are the seeds which produce the crop they hope later to gather. Everywhere they fan the flames of hatred between peoples of the same blood. It is they who invented class warfare. And the repudiation of this theory must therefore always be an anti-Jewish measure. In the same way, any doctrine which is anti-communist, any doctrine which is anti-Christian, must ipso facto be anti-Jewish as well. The National Socialist doctrine is therefore anti-Jewish in excelsis, for it is both anti-communist and anti-Christian. National Socialism is solid to the core, and the whole of its strength is concentrated against the Jews, even in matters which appear to have a purely social aspect and are designed for the furtherance of the social amenities of our own people. The Fuhrer concluded, Bergdorf has just given me a paper which deals with the relationship between communism and Christianity. It is comforting to see how, even in these days, the fatal relationship between the two is daily becoming clearer to the human intelligence. And that's how Hitler's table talk concludes.
Right, quite an ending.
Yes.
I must say, very effective. I didn't know that it was meant. It was meant that way. It just happened that way.
Yeah.
You know, right. I know you have things to say about this, but what just occurred to me as you were reading it now was that Bormann is trying to say that National Socialism is anti-Christian. And a lot of National Socialists at that time would have disagreed with him. And Hitler never allowed him to say or, you know, make it any kind of policy or anything like that, which he often tried to do. And, you know, kind of sneak it in here and there that National Socialism was anti-Christian. But here they're just talking, and Hitler apparently is not in disagreement with him, or is not going to make an issue of it anyway. But then it was never put out at all that as a fact or a policy or anything that National Socialism was anti-Christian. In fact, it was pretty much Christian friendly for sure. So I just struck me just now that Bormann is.
Yeah.
Is doing that.
Well, that's a good point about Bormann. I think, you know, as you say, there were many, many National Socialists who were devout Christians. And so for Bormann to say the National Socialist doctrine is therefore anti-Jewish in excelsis, for it is both anti-communist and anti-Christian, And the reason I think that Borman would make such a statement was because he, more than most people, linked Christianity to Jewish origins. And he saw it as a manipulative Jewish power grab. And so he had his opinions. And I admired the man for being straight up and honest and speaking his mind. And, you know, and so he was a free thinker. And the fact that he didn't back off or let fear of something religious silence him was a good quality, in my estimation, to share his ideas with Hitler and his inner circle. And one thing that characterizes Bormann above all is loyalty to the Führer and loyalty to the principles of National Socialism. So I have no quarrel with the man's belief about his spiritual let's say comfort or whatever, that's his business. And so I was not in the least offended by anything Borman said here. So
well, but you know, as people will say, Ray, this just occurred to me just now, and I have to say, I guess to be open and fair about it, I have to say that he may have, knowing that these talks were coming to an end, he may have added his words there, which maybe weren't necessary. But in just in order to get that message out there, although Hitler had already said it, and Bormann
right.
was just emphasizing it. And now the other
That's
thing
right.
is that Paul of this Paul of Tarsus thing that Hitler has mentioned more on other occasions too, that Paul was the real creator of Christianity by manipulating it into something different than Jesus had in mind. And he was a Jew, and he never really changed that. He just changed his name and so on. I wonder how old this theory is. It's very common today, but Hitler seemed to have taken it up, but I don't know where he got it or where they got it. Bormann obviously agreed with all of that, as you pointed out. So, but it leaves us. It leaves Table Talk on a note that runs through Table Talk probably, if not more, at least as much as any other theme that we find there. That's why it seems so appropriate to me.
Me too. And personally, I think that Dietrich Eckart had an influence with that. I think Hitler's reading of different German philosophers, including Nietzsche, kind of maybe opened his eyes to a different way of thinking and things like this. So, like you said,
thinking way, way back, you know, as a teenager, he was already not a believer in Christianity. He wasn't,
right.
you know, and but he was still respectful of his elders and tradition and his mother and all of this stuff. So he didn't go around making a problem about that. That wasn't his main interest or his main thing was, to change religion. He really was just incidental that it came out during his regime because he had to have a relationship with the churches, which were very powerful. But, you know, it's not something that he ever made a big deal of, but he lost that religious feeling shortly after he, you know, adolescence, I would say, you know, after he stopped being a child and was very impressed with the monastery and the church and where he lived and so on. Right? That was the only grand thing that was going on and was really his aesthetic sense, his as an artist, that made him a become so fond of the church and hang out there and even think about maybe that's where he would, you know, go into a vocation or something for a short while. You know how many young people think like that. Doesn't last very long.
Right.
Passing thing. But it was really the only place that he saw a form of art and architecture of these buildings and so on and grand things that attracted him very much. But later he dismissed all that. And he never was religious. And then, like
right.
you say, you brought up Dietrich Eckart. And he and Dietrich Eckart talked about that. Eckart was very anti-Christian. And Eckhart was kind of like his mentor in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
He couldn't have, he didn't escape that. He just didn't, when he was building the party, he knew what the German people, how they felt and how they believed, and he wasn't going to go against
that. Right.
And I don't consider that hypocritical at all. It was
even
more respectful, but it was also smart politics, you know. I mean,
sure.
He had to do it, so. He didn't rock the boat.
That's right. And, Carolyn, the last two sentences that conclude that section right there and end the book, let me go with those one more time. Burgdorf has just given me a paper which deals with the relationship between communism and Christianity. It is comforting to see how, even in these days, the fatal relationship between the two is daily becoming clearer to the human intelligence. Very important right there, because that little phrase, it's comforting to see how, even in these days. Now, those days were late November 1944, and the Russian onslaught was pushing its way further and further into Europe. The fight against the communist beast was not going the way of National Socialist Germany by any means. And you would have, you know, what he's saying there is, you know, the communists are closing in here, and for people to start seeing and recognizing a relationship between communism and Christianity, that people were still seeing that relationship rather than just, you know, letting it go and not paying any attention to it. So he says the fatal relationship between those two is daily becoming clearer to the human intelligence, linking Christianity to communism. And they weren't the only ones that did that or thought that way. But and as you say, it's not that uncommon today to link the two. Some of the basic tenets of the two are indeed communal, communistic in nature.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So,
well, yeah, that's all very true. And, you know, I'll just say here, I guess it's pertinent here. I want to remind the listeners, if they didn't pick up on it yet, that we're scheduled for 2 hours tonight. So we can go 2 hours with no problem, and then we can even go longer than that off the live show for tonight, but we'll still be recorded if we want to. So if we take our time here, don't think that this is all we're going to say. We've got a lot to say planned. So I'm going to just go back to my other page. And Ray, you were going to start us out if you're done talking about this last portion.
Yes.
And so, you know, now we're going to talk about the book as a whole.
Right. And I appreciate you letting me take off with this, Carolyn, because I'm going to make a little personal statement here about Table Talk, what it's meant to me, and this journey that we've taken through it. And mine is more of a generalization, this statement, and I know you're going to get into specifics, and I will too just a little bit, you know, later in the show. But I'm just going to take off with this. This is my own feelings about when we started this over a year ago and how we wound up today. When Carolyn proposed this study of Hitler's Table Talk, there were some negative messages implying, why are you wasting your time on a forgery? Hitler's Table Talk is just as much a fake as those Hitler diaries. It's the work of Martin Bormann. Thus, my primary purpose in reading Table Talk was to decide for myself if the book was indeed the words of the Fuhrer, or was it a fake? After some 56 weeks of study, my conclusion, reached actually after a very short time, is that this compilation is indeed the authentic words of the Fuhrer, and that the time spent reading this book has been well invested and worth it. I also concluded that those who spoke negatively at the idea of such a study did so for one of two reasons. They had not read the book for themselves, had just taken someone else's word for it, or they want to discourage others from reading it. Now, what is it that would prompt someone to discourage others from reading this book? Number one, it reveals that Adolf Hitler was not the demonic madman as portrayed to the world, but was certainly a most intelligent, thinking, and rational individual. Number two, reading the book prompts rethinking, a reassessing of what we've been told and taught about the man and of National Socialism. What did Table Talk do for me regarding my own beliefs about the Fuhrer and National Socialism? Hitler's Table Talk was an affirmation of the greatness of both. Did Table Talk demonstrate the statesmanship of Adolf Hitler? Well, it certainly did. But it also revealed Hitler the man. The entire book demonstrates the remarkable knowledge possessed by the Fuhrer on such a vast array of topics, not only history and religion, but architecture, art, music, dancing, archaeology, food, race, and an understanding of people. His empathy for the common man, his burning impetus to make life better for so many people. Table Talk affirms his love of children and animals, his moral uprightness, his value of the physical and mental fitness of his people, his own health, regimen of no smoking, no alcohol. Table Talk revealed his prankishness and his sense of humor as a youngster as well as an adult. Learning all of these things and more through Table Talk plainly reveals why Jews and those who have swallowed Jewish lies would discourage the reading of this book, calling it a forgery and a waste of time. The enemy cannot deny his contributions through National Socialism of ending unemployment, the Autobahnen, the Volkswagen, vacations for the working people, Hitler's dedication to cleaning up German cities, making high culture more available to the masses, using his influence to make the courts and justice system more fair and equitable through common sense. In short, the Fuhrer embodied and stood for the very virtues necessary for a safe and sane, well-ordered society. His life, his genius, his actions on behalf of his nation showed the path toward a truly utopian society that could be attained. His greatness was evidenced in Table Talk, but so indeed was his modesty. He was a true Renaissance man. And that's what I just embellished. Table Talk just did so much to point in all of those directions. So why people who are very anti-Hitler, anti-National Socialism, would not want someone to read it, because it offers a fair picture of the man himself and nothing that you can attack and ridicule. Sure, there are things in there about race and religion that people would take issue with and differ, but thinking people would not make them hate the man and demonize him as it has been done for the past many, many decades. So, Carolyn, that's what reading this book has done for me and what it has meant for me. Opened the door to what an all-around genius that man was.
Yeah, did it change your mind about anything that
no,
you can
it was
think
an
of?
Affirmation, you know. I have read a lot about Hitler, his movement, the early days. You know, I've read some of the writings of Goebbels, Rosenberg, Hitler himself, even Goering, and learned much about National Socialism, and then of course Mein Kampf, and all. I've read that many, many years ago, and my opinion of the man was always favorable, and I thought his movement was extremely common sense, and was not a hate thing towards anyone, and you know, when you learn that this, what I was taught in school is a lie. The man was not out to conquer the world. His nation was about the size of Texas, and they're taking on the entire rest of the world, the biggest powers in the world, and they're going to conquer it. And it's not just the conquering. You have to occupy it. How ridiculous that claim was. Mm-hmm. And so when I started seeing through that stuff, I think I formed my positive opinions about the man, the nation itself, and way back from when he was a young man, and then his World War One experiences, and then in Landisburg and all. And so, no, this nothing in here was negative to me about him, and it was an affirmation, as I said, Carolyn. It affirmed my personal beliefs that I had formed over decades in studying about Hitler and National Socialism. This book was a blessing.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad you discovered it through this program we've done together, because you weren't even particularly
exactly
familiar with this particular book. See, and that's,
you know,
why
that's
this book has been kept down so much.
Mm-hmm.
For the
that's
very
an
reasons
excellent
you've
point
been saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I meant to say that to you until you mentioned this book to me and asked me would I team up with you and do a reading of it, and I had never heard of this book.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, wow, you know, that one's escaped me, and then I went on Amazon.com. I got a copy of the book itself, and I was stunned because I didn't even know it was available, you know, and so you're right. It has been kind of under the radar and kept kind of under wraps by those who don't want us reading anything positive about National Socialist Germany.
Well, you know, the same. I learned about this book quite a ways back. It had been maybe around 2005 or something, and 2006 maybe, and I was right away, somebody said, oh, this book, you got to read this book. And somebody else said, oh, this is Hitler's private talks, you know, at the table. And I thought, oh, that's almost too good to be true, you know. And then somebody else said, oh, that's questionable, you know, we don't know if that's authentic or not. I don't know whatever word they use, but, you know, that's you got to be careful with that and all. And that put me off right away because I didn't want to read anything about Hitler that I thought was by Hitler that wasn't real, and I knew of other things that were fake. So I stayed
right
away from it for the longest time, and it was just not all that long ago that I always wanted to read it, and I finally, maybe I was thinking about doing the book for the study hour, and I asked Hasso Kastrup, who's a good, very good translator, lives in Europe and knows a number of languages, and I asked him about it, if he knew if the book was correct or if it was translated wrongly about the Christianity parts, especially. That's what was bothering me. And
yeah,
he said, no, it's all good. I said, well, how do you know?
Yeah.
I was suspicious of him. You know, how do you know? And do you have the German editions?
Right.
Yes, he said he did, both by Picker and by Heim. He said, there's nothing wrong with the Cameron Stevens translation, which was the only one that was available to us in English.
Yeah.
And and I said, wow, I was still uncertain, you know, and I said, well, would you translate some of these passages about Christianity? I mean, would you, you know, give them and check them all out and see that they're translated correctly? And he sent me about 12 of them that he translated and said they're all just like what's in the German. And that's when it broke through for me. And I thought, well, boy, you know, and then I wanted to do the book. Now, the other thing that I was going to say is that I was nervous about, I've always been nervous about Hitler making anti-Christian statements back in those days, and not up until recently. So this book has made a big change for me. I admit, you know, and I'm happy to say so, that it's really made an impression where I understand now that definitely Hitler, in spite of his public pronouncements and so on, was privately not Christian and hadn't, as I said earlier, really had never been since he was a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I was both uncertain about that, and I was also very worried about saying so, and because I didn't want to offend Christians that I knew and liked and,
sure,
and who are National Socialists and are fond of it and think of it as Christian, and it fits in
mm-hmm.
with all of their own philosophies. And I was
mm-hmm.
really sensitive about that. So I was always
sure
trying to step around gingerly and really think of Hitler as a Christian more than he was, or he's sort of Christian, you know. I mean, but after reading the book, Ray and listeners, I just can't do that anymore. And it's convinced me 100%. Not that it, well, I guess it's just that it's Hitler's personal views are simply mm-hmm. not Christian. And anybody who wants to make out that they were, I would have to, you know, in the interest of truth, simply argue against it or stay quiet, I guess. But, you know,
right.
They're wrong. But they're just plain wrong.
And as you said a while ago, Carolyn, you know, just for the fact that, you know, he may have said some things that we learn in this book that obviously shows he was not Christian, did not mean in the least that he was anti-Christian. And you know, it's like, so how do Christians feel about other religions of the world and what they think about Christians? And so they would say, well, they're entitled to their opinion about it. And taking on this book to see if we thought it was viable and the real thing, I knew that you were certainly quite capable of critical thinking, and I felt like, well, I am too. And together reading this thing, we're going to discern pretty quickly if it's a fraud or not. And mm-hmm. part of it was what was going to be said about the Jews, what was going to be said about the Christian religion. And the further we got into the book, the picture became clearer and clearer for me, just like it, you said it did for you. And it didn't take long for me to decide that, these fellas that jotted this stuff down at Hitler's dinner table wrote down what the man actually said.
Yeah, there was more on Christianity than I expected. I only knew of some of them, and I had the ones that Hasso sent to me, and I thought that was all of them. I thought he had sent me all of them. Then as we started reading, Ray, you know, and in the early part, in 1941, he had some of the strongest comments that are the most objected to. And I was like, wow, this is really strong language, you know.
Right.
More than I expected. But now that we've been through it, it's been a little over a year, I'm quite comfortable with it all, because as mm-hmm. you, I mean, I'm a fan of Adolf Hitler, and if, you know, exactly. I'm not going to think that he shouldn't have said what he said. And besides, he was talking in private, and his people who knew him in private all knew this about him. They all knew it, but he didn't make
that's
it
right.
public, and we've already covered that. So now
yes.
I'd like to make sure that everyone knows, I put this together this afternoon, that everyone knows that the Werner Jachmann German language complete notes taken down by Heinrich Heine, which is called the Bormann Vermerke, or Bormann notes, which is what the Heine material is called, is available on the internet at, it's a PDF that's been uploaded by GermanVictims.com. It has a lot of other stuff there. But it's called, the book is Adolf Hitler Monologue für Hauptquartier. And it's actually Adolf Hitler's monologue at Führer Headquarters, 1941-1944. And so that's, I just learned about that when I finally was talking to Hasso again. And I said, I wish I could see the, is there any place where that German is available? And he said, yeah, it's on the internet. Maybe it hadn't been then, you know, earlier. But he told me where to go, and I was just, wow, here it is. So I started comparing our Cameron and Stevens translation with passages on that. And they all compared perfectly well. And I've asked other people to look at it, and they said, yeah, they don't see any problem with these translations. And a whole lot of what has been said by the critics is that there are terrible differences in the translation by Cameron and Stevens that don't fit what's in the original. And that's just not true. It's absolutely untrue. And then on Wikipedia, on their Hitler's Table Talk page, they say, all editions and translations are based on the two original German notebooks, one by Henry Picker and another based on a more complete notebook by Martin Bormann. They don't mention Heim, they call it Martin Bormann's, which is often called the Bormann Vermerke or Bormann Notes. That's what they say. Although it's the notes taken down by Heim and stored by Bormann, but they want to, everybody seems to want to make out that they even let you believe that Martin Borman took the notes, you know. This is by Martin Borman. And then we know that Henry Ficker stood in for Haim between March 12th and September 1st, 1942. But his notes are not in this German version that I just told you about, that GermanVictims.com put up. But they are in the book we're using. They were added by, what's that guy's name now? Hugh Trevor Roper is the editor of that book, and that's put a big black mark on that book. Oh, he's a British, and he was a scumbag, and he did write this terrible foreword introduction to the book, very, very anti-Hitler, but it's not even there on that PDF that I'm using. I took it from, and we didn't read it. We haven't even talked about it or looked at it. You don't have to pay attention to that, but I think the translation by Cameron and Stevens is perfectly good and accurate. So it doesn't matter that it's Trevor Roper. Really, you have to look at the other end. Okay, I think I've covered all that. And as I said, it dovetails perfectly with the original Haim and Ficker notes. Now, I haven't seen the Ficker notes in German, but others say that it does. So that's not available to me at the moment. But we have all the Haim notes in German. And it's been interesting, for I've looked up a few things when it comes to the word extermination, stuff like that, you know, to see what the original German word was. I found some interesting things, which I'll mention. Let's see. I want to say something else that Wikipedia says on their page, just to show the way they slant things. Although considered authentic, contentious issues remain over particular aspects of the work, including the reliability of particular translated statements within the French and English editions. Well, I've just dealt with that. And, you know, they keep bringing up the French, but the Cameron and Stevens translated from the German. So the French edition by this Genot doesn't have anything to do with it, as far as I know. But then they also say the questionable manner in which Martin Borman may have edited his notes, and disputes over which edition is most reliable. But none of that means anything except how they stick in here Martin Borman saying, and notice the word may, you know? There's no...
Yes. Oh, yeah.
It's all speculation. Martin Borman may have changed this, you know, in a questionable manner. Nothing points to that. But that's how they do it. So anyway, onward. Do you want to make any comments about any of that?
Well, just there at the end, another example that sprung to mind to me about, you know, where they say Borman may have done this. When I was taking a history of Nazi Germany a number of years ago over here at the University of Houston, Victoria, we were assigned to read four or five books, all of them by Jewish authors, and, of course, nearly all of them were so-called Holocaust survivors and whatever. But this one was Lucy Davidovits. And anyway, and I'm reading that stuff, and she's talking about people that are saying this couldn't have happened and whatever. They say that there's no written orders to carry this out and things like this. And she said, no, there's not any written down, not anything found. But, and then she quoted a couple of notes there where this term final solution was used. And she said, now this is what the Germans would tell you that this note meant. But what it probably meant was, you know, death to all the Jews. Yeah, what it probably meant was, see, and then you said that Google saying it may have meant this, see, and they get away with idiocy like that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's all I wanted to add to that.
That's pretty bad. It's pretty bad that that they get away with it in books that are supposed to be by scholars and on Wikipedia pages and so on. Well, anyway, number one element in Hitler's thinking, I think, is the importance of race. And I read a statement last Monday, but I think I should read it again because it comes from a table talk, but I don't know where. It's just a number of things was looking for today and yesterday, but I couldn't find them. There's so much to go through. But I found some of it. If I try to gauge my work, Hitler said, I must consider, first of all, that I've contributed in a world that had forgotten the notion to the triumph of the idea of the primacy of race. So that's what he is saying that he, you know, he feels is the most important of his work. And secondly, sure, I've given German supremacy a solid cultural foundation. In fact, mm-hmm, the power we today enjoy cannot be justified in my eyes. And this is the power they were enjoying in, say, 41, 42, I don't think it was in 43, yes, one of those 2 years,
right,
except by the establishment and expansion of a mighty culture. To achieve this must be the law of our existence. So he's connecting culture with race, and he's putting a high importance on culture, and we find that in Table Talk that he comments so often on aesthetics and his passion for all the arts, but especially architecture, and he talks about artists and dance and music and in every kind of field of art and culture he's involved in it. And this is was the other probably what he talked about most, other than the Christian.
That's right.
He talked about that on, and you know, every so often we were covering that. So, but I'm not going to talk about that tonight because it's not controversial. I'm going to talk about some controversial things, and we have made that point, I think, many times, how that was so important to his personality and who he was. And of course, there was also the theme of German expansionism that came up quite often. I'm not going to go into that either because it's kind of complex, you know. And he spoke of it in conjunction with the little bit of war talk he did. And I think we have made the point that he didn't really talk about the war. Once in a while,
that's right,
you know, it came up. He said things that were very interesting. But it wasn't a time and a place that he wanted to talk about the war, nor would he. It was mixed company. All the people that worked down there, you know, close to him, were there, the secretaries. There was women and men. And he wasn't going to discuss these issues. This was just for, you know, light talk and small talk and him expressing things he felt like he wanted to that were on his mind. But he did make this comment, which I'll mention. Well, we know that he wanted to expand into Ukraine and Crimea for agriculture and natural resources. That was his goal, and he said at the outbreak of the First World War, many people thought we ought to look towards the mineral riches of the West, the raw materials of the colonies, and the gold. For my part, I always thought that having the sun in the East was the essential thing for us, and today I have no reason to modify my point of view. This was on July 27th and 28th, probably at nighttime, 1941, and this was his general view that he expressed more than once.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, now the big thing, of course, I've already said the big thing for me was his views on religion, and it's the most controversial part of the book. In fact, if you go to the Table Talk Wikipedia page, they have a little stuff in the beginning, then they have a whole long section called religion, and that's it. They don't that's the only thing they discuss there about Table Talk is Hitler's views on religion and all the other all the people who disagree with him. So I'm going to just to show the breadth of the things that he said and the variety, the direction that they were going in. I've got 20 things I'm going to comment here on. I'm not going to comment.
Good.
I'm mostly going to read them chronologically. So July 11th and 12th, 1941. Man has discovered in nature the wonderful notion of that almighty being whose law he worships. Fundamentally, in everything, there is the feeling for this almighty, which we call God. That is to say, the dominion of natural laws throughout the whole universe. And, you know, that was I think, in the very first segment or, you know, very first reading in the book. It started in July, maybe it was July 5th or something, 41. This is July 11th, 12th. But this is his whole idea in a nutshell here, that he's a believer. And he's a believer in an almighty force and which we call God, he says, and he doesn't believe in atheism. He absolutely rejects atheism and didn't want any atheism to enter into Germany or the German people or any, you know, into Europe. Thought it was, of course, it was Jewish and it was the bad thing. But he connects God with natural laws. And he believed that when you look at nature and you see how it functions and how it works, that's God is revealing himself throughout the entire universe, you know, is that. So then he went on a little bit later to say, we don't want to educate anyone in atheism. Belief in God is necessary. And on July 15th, 1941, he said the heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity. So right there already was a pretty strong statement for those who wouldn't be expecting it and would be surprised by it. And he said, Bolshevism is Christianity's illegitimate child. Both are inventions of the Jew. So you can understand what he said here in the beginning and he said at the very end. So you can understand Bormann saying what he did and knowing he wasn't going against Adolf Hitler, except in saying what he said about National Socialism. And another part of this, Hitler says, claims to bring liberty to men, whereas in reality it seeks only to enslave them. Well, Christianity claims, both Christianity and communism is what this is supposed to be, and Bolshevism, I mean, claim to bring liberty, where in reality they seek only to enslave men. That's pretty strong. I took the strong ones here in some cases. And then he also, on that same day, said, in the long run, here's where Bormann maybe gets this. he said, in the long run, National Socialism and religion will no longer be able to exist together. But he's looking, you know, as you're always calling Hitler far-seeing, you know, he's looking into the future, not right now.
Yes.
And, right. And he says, without Christianity, we should not have had Islam. And then he says some other things, but then he means that both of those things extinguished 15 centuries of civilization at a single stroke. And the 15 centuries of civilization he's referring to Greek and Roman civilization, which he was a great fan of, and saw that these religions just brought us into a kind of a dark ages, which he talks about at different times and describes, but not real deeply, not in real detail. But and so now the third one I've got here is that, actually the fourth, but there will never be any possibility of National Socialism setting out to ape religion by establishing a form of worship. Its one ambition must be scientifically to construct a doctrine that is nothing more than an homage to reason. So he often brings up reason. And he has been known to say in these pages that when he has an important decision to make, or it's a, he has to approach it through cold reason. You know, he knows how to separate emotional feelings and so on from decisions that have to be made for the good of the German nation. And some of these I shortened quite a bit. He criticizes the church on September 27th and 8th and 41 because he says the church encourages the poor to remain poor. See, now there again is that aspect of him that you mentioned so often, Ray, that he cares about the common people, and he did he brought the level of the working people up, and of course he brought the respect for working people. That was the big thing. He brought that way up,
right,
to make them equal partners in the nation, and what they did was just as important as what intellectuals did or what military leaders did and so on. So this is one of the things he really holds against the church, particularly the Catholic Church, its long history of keeping the poor poorer and saying that God liked them better that way. They get to heaven and they get their reward. And he mentions here on October 10th, Christianity in relationship to the cultivation of human failure. Goes along with the communism. And then a long one on October 14th, 1941. It's really an important, one of his more important monologues on Christianity. October 14th, 1941. I'm just actually got down here the topic headings that come at the beginning of each one to just show what was in it, because I couldn't write it all down. But he talks about the disadvantages of a concordat with the churches, the difficulty of compromising with a lie. That might be that one that I was looking for and didn't find. No truck with religion for the party. He didn't want religion in the party. Antagonism of dogma and science. And here, one of the themes that comes up more and more is that we discovered he's a man of a progressive thinking and future forward thinking, and he's more and more embracing science. He believes in science, and he sees that the religious dogma, when it's against science, and so much of it at that time, you know, really was. They didn't try to move past it like they're doing today. So it just didn't fit at all. And he says, he talks about letting Christianity die slowly. We've discussed that before. You know, he wasn't going to do anything rash. He wasn't going to get into a battle with the churches, because he felt that their time was limited anyway because of the rise of science. And the metaphysical needs of the soul he talked about. And he certainly didn't dismiss the soul, and he certainly believed in the human soul. And he says a no-state religion, well, you know, he had wanted a state religion. And then he's talking about how he's changed his mind about that. And he believes in freedom of belief. And then he also adds here, he thinks, you know, religious belief should be one of the things that people should have a choice on. You shouldn't dictate to people what their religious beliefs would be, unless they get real weird or against the state. In Germany, you couldn't have a religion that was opposed to the state, like the Jehovah's Witnesses were, because they wouldn't serve in the army. You had to follow all the things of the state, but then you could have your own beliefs. But he also added here, nothing would be more foolish than to reestablish the worship of Wotan or Votan. Now there, yes, you know, where we have a lot of people who say they're National Socialists or who are, but they want to bring back those pagan religions. And there was a lot of people in Germany that did. Even Himmler didn't so much want to do that, but he was open to all of that stuff. And Hitler was never was. He never was. He just would make fun of it. He'd say, "Yeah, how are you going to do that? You know, we've moved on. You know, we don't think the same way." And so he didn't believe in any kind of religious stories. You know, he wanted people to grow up and think more sophisticatedly. So anyway, that was the October 14, 1941. October 19th, now in October 41, he really was really talking about it. And a few days later, he said, Christianity is a prototype of Bolshevism. There's that theme again. The mobilization by the Jew of the masses of slaves with the object of undermining society. And then on the 21st, 2 days later, he had a long talk about, here's where he brought up Julian the Apostate, and who he admired from the Roman Empire, and talked about the Aryan origin of Jesus, the distortion of Christ's ideas. You know, when you read tonight's reading where he said,
yes, Jesus mentioned that,
could not be a Jew. And there's some of that in here too. And it makes so much sense. He says that they would never have given one of their own over to the Rome court.
That's right.
And he uses other reasons why he couldn't have been a Jew. So that's why he has good reasons for saying that Jesus was not a Jew. And he talks about the road to Damascus, where he goes into all that story of Paul and so on there. And the Roman tolerance, meaning that Rome was very tolerant of religions, and that didn't turn out so well for them. And materialism in the Jewish religion, and religion as a subversive method. So there's a lot of people would relate to that. And the mobilization of the slaves, and St. Paul and Karl Marx. Boy, he really has no love lost for St. Paul. Then he says the works of man must perish on the 24th of October. Religion versus science, the church's explanation of natural phenomena, science hits back and the church and religious beliefs. So he's talking a lot about the church in that one, but I didn't take any quotes from it. Again, here's a real, real long one. On October 25th, yeah, that's a real important one. October 25th, 1941, he starts out with the libraries of antiquity. He talks again about Christianity and Bolshevism, that they aim at destruction. And he said that Nero did not burn Rome. I remember that vaguely when we read about that. And some Rome was burned, I guess, by the Christians or something, and by somebody, but not by Nero, he didn't think. And the hypocrisy of Protestants, the Catholic Church thrives on sin. Well, you know what that means is that the Catholic Church had the power, they're the only ones with the power for Catholics to forgive sin. You couldn't go and pray to Jesus Christ and ask for forgiveness or anything like that. In the Catholic Church, you had to get it through your priest. And so that kept everybody in the church and going to
the money-making project of selling indulgences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But even without that, it kept them there because they knew they were all going to sin all the time, so they had to get that forgiveness. Because if you had sin on your soul, you're not going to get into heaven, you know. You're going to have to work it off in purgatory. And all these kind of rules, it keeps the church going. And and he talked about the modernist movement back in 41 in October, which I didn't, I don't know, but we talked about it more recently. It made more of an impression on me then. And the problem of convents and, you know, all that stuff. And then November 11th, 1941, he said, "What is in opposition to the laws of nature cannot come from God." And moreover, he said, "Thunderbolts do not spare churches." So again, he's, you know, gets back to the natural law business and saying if something is against natural law, how can it come of God? Because natural law comes of God. So what else can it come from, you know? Really. And more of the same kind of topics. He's bringing up the SS and religion. I think that's where he said that the SS was free of religion. I think he was saying that. And then he's discussing the Carroll, one of those Protestants, K-E-R-R-L, in his government, who was attempting the synthesis between National Socialism and Christianity. And he said then, now on December 14th, 41, which he supported at the time, back at that time in the 30s, but now he says in December 41 that, "I don't believe the thing's possible to attempt a synthesis between National Socialism and Christianity." So he had moved away from that to that degree. And he sees the obstacle in Christianity itself.
Right.
Naturally, not in National Socialism. Then he starts talking about in 42, February, "We shan't be able to go on evading the religious problem much longer. If anyone thinks it's really essential to build the life of human society on a foundation of lies, well, in my estimation, such a society is not worth preserving." So these are very offensive to people whenever he talks about it being a lie, you know. And then he says on February 17th, 1942, "The sensational event of the ancient world was the mobilization of the underworld against the established order. This enterprise of Christianity had no more to do with religion than Marxist socialism has to do with the solution of the social problem." So here he's going pretty strong, too, saying that the rise of Christianity was just an effort to destroy the established order, which was the Roman power at that time. And then he starts talking about all the money that they're paying the German churches. We talked about that not so long ago.
Right. Oh, yeah, we went into that.
And Niemöller and so on. Some of this it's from April 42, but that wasn't all that long ago that we were reading this, because after 42 it gets so short. Well, I think I've got a few more, but I think I've covered everything. Oh, here's one I don't want to forget. He said on July 4th, 1942, "Once the war is over, we will put a swift end to the Concordat. It will give me the greatest personal pleasure to point out to the church all those occasions on which it has broken the terms of it. One need only recall the close cooperation between the church and the murderers of Heydrich. Catholic priests not only allowed them to hide in a church on the outskirts of Prague, but even allowed them to entrench themselves in the sanctuary of the altar. Now, you see, this really made him mad. He's really holding anger about this. We know how much
right.
he thought of Heydrich and how important Heydrich was, and that these church people allowed these assassins to hide. And in fact, there was this big battle, you know, in this church in Prague where they were finally killed. But even though these were, I suppose, Czech priests, I wouldn't think they would be German priests. He still held them
right.
ransom because the Czechs were under German control then, and they were supposed to be doing what was, you know, what their government was telling them, because the government was certainly on the German side, on Hitler's side about this, you know, ostensibly. But that these Catholic priests were all that, and that's why there are so many Catholic priests in Buchenwald and not mostly in Dachau and in some other camps. Not because he hated Catholics and didn't like priests and wanted to arrest them and put them in the concentration camps. They were put in there because they're all working against the state, against his state, and against his government. They, you know, the priests at that time, the church at that time was very political, and the local churches and the priests and so on were very political, and so many of them were I guess you'd say communist or liberal, or, you know, were against National Socialism, and they were actively working against it. So they got arrested and they were put away in these places to keep them, you know, out of trouble, to keep them there out of the business that they shouldn't be getting into. And they were treated very well too at Dachau. All the priests were, they didn't have to work, and they had pretty nice quarters to live in. And they were given each one a whole bottle of wine every day, because they were used to drinking wine. Maybe it was to make them happy.
Yeah.
But yet, it's always shown, promoted as how he was persecuting the priests and the church and so on. It wasn't really true at all. Well, so there we go. This is from Stigmund Gall. His book, The Holy Reich, is a pretty good book about Christianity and Hitler and National Socialism. And he said after 1938, Hitler began to publicly support science, particularly social Darwinism, at the core of Nazi ideology in place of a religious one, a development that is reflected in private in his increasingly hostile remarks towards religion in table talk. And, you know, in the 20s, he was speaking very positively about Christianity. Sometimes. There was just a couple of speeches where he said, you know, as a Christian, I feel it's my duty to this and that, you know. But, you know, it was real early in his career. And he thought that would be a good point to make with them. But
sure.
At least he did speak that way then. And people want to think that he continued to, but he didn't. So what were you going to say, Ray?
Well, I just, going back to your start on this religious stuff, when you mentioned, certainly, that we covered in this book about Hitler said absolutely no teaching of atheism, and, you know, and he talked about the Creator and everything. I was just going to say that is very, very parallel to the beliefs of the man that I consider the greatest of our founding fathers and the smartest, most intelligent, reasonable, rational men who've ever held the office of President of the United States. That ran very parallel with Thomas Jefferson and his deism. He wasn't an atheist, but he did not embrace the Christian religion either. But he had to play the game because so many people around him were not on his level, and he could have damaged himself because, you know, how strong the religion, the hold it had at that time, even more so than now. But I'm glad you brought that point up. Let's see, there was one other thing I was going to say about mine. I picked this short quote from the 20th of May, 1942, where he says, "I am firmly opposed to any attempt to export National Socialism. If other countries are determined to preserve their democratic systems and thus rush to their ruin, so much the better for us." And I always liked reading that when I came across it because it, you know, it flies in the face of, well, Hitler was trying to conquer the world, make us all speak German, turn us all into goose-stepping national socialists, et cetera, et cetera. He knew that that form of government was German, Germanic, and it would work for his people, but maybe not for someone else. And he wasn't out to force that form of government on anybody. And, you know, we had a lot in the book about colonies. Hitler would mention, you know, when the war is over, we're gonna make outposts in little towns and things in Ukraine and the Crimea and things like this. But he stressed that we will not upset the apple cart by trying to put these people under our form of government, make them follow our practices and things like this, and leave these people alone and let them have their local beliefs and what they do. And, you know, we're not out to try to make Germans of them. And so anyway, that I thought of that on something you were saying a while ago, but that's all I had for that.
Okay, well, that's going to come up again if I get to it. You know, I'm taking too long as usual. I'm famous for that. But there's a person named Richard Carrier, sticking with this Christianity theme for a little bit. Richard Carrier is the person that's always quoted, and he happens to be an atheist, you know, but he's quoted by all these Christians who deny table talk and as being Hitler and use his arguments. And he maintains that much of Trevor Roper's English edition, which is what we're using, is actually a verbatim translation of Janus' French and not the original German. But you see, that's just not true. I say that's an outright lie. I can't exactly prove it because I don't have Janus' French, but I know that once I got access as Heim's German edition published by Werner Jachmann in German, that is an exact translation. Well, no, nothing, you know, translations are a little bit different, but it comes out the same. So I don't believe that he knows what he's talking about, and he was a fairly young guy when he was saying all this. And his thesis is that a textual analysis between Picker's original German text and Janus' French translation reveals that Janus' version is at best a poor translation, and in some instances fraudulent. Well, we're not using Janus' translation. We're using Cameron and Stevens' translation from Jachmann's publication of Heim's Notes, as I said, which is also called the Bormann Ver America. So a lot of the stuff that people are saying, they're just talking in the air, you know, and if you try to, I didn't have all this information in the past to respond to them. But I do now. So Carrier argues that no one who quotes this text is quoting what Hitler actually said. From this little bit that he's come up with, he says if you quote this text that we're using, you're not quoting what Hitler actually said. Well, I just say bull to that. He's an atheist. He's a far-left anti-Hitler type. And the reason he's gotten into this is because he wants, in my opinion, he wants Hitler to be a Christian. He wants people to see Hitler as a Christian because he thinks Christianity is real bad and dumb and stupid, and that then Hitler will be seen as a dumb, stupid person who was a Christian but who put people to death and who knows what all, you know, stuff like that. It's because he's totally anti-Christian, and I have a couple of examples of things that I worked out that he says is the right translation or is the wrong translation or whatever. I've got all these various translations, but I'm not going to go into that because it'll just bore people. It'll take way too long.
Mm-hmm.
So much for that. And I wanted to also bring out that he spoke not as much at all, but the reason I'm bringing it up is because it's very controversial too, his attitude toward Russian Slavs and Stalin. So I've got some quotes here that he made in Table Talk about these subjects, not as much as I had for religion, but on the 5th of July, or either that or the 7th of May, 41, he said, by instinct, the Russian does not incline towards a higher form of society. Certain peoples can live in such a way that with them, a collection of family units does not make a whole. And although Russia has set up a social system which, judged by Western standards, qualifies for the designation state, it is not, in fact, a system which is either congenial or natural to her. And then he says, in the eyes of the Russian, the principal support of civilization is vodka. His ideal consists in never doing anything but the indispensable. Our German conception of work, which is work and then more of it, which I found humorous, is one that he submits to as if it were a real curse. Well, Hitler here is saying, is indicating he sees a big difference between the Russian and the German. And he's of course looking at the kind of the peasant Russian. You know, not so much looking at the ones that are in the city, maybe. But I think that he has a point there when it comes to... he never thought that the Germans should connect up with the Russians. And a lot of people do. And a lot of people think that today. So I'm just bringing this up because this is one of the things that a lot of people hold against Table Talk. And that night, later that same day at night, he said... What matters is that Bolshevism must be exterminated. In case of necessity, we shall renew our advance wherever a new center of resistance is formed. Moscow, and see, they were doing well then. This is in 41 still, so he's saying they're going to continue to go after Bolshevism. And he says, Moscow, as the center of the doctrine, must disappear from the earth's surface as soon as its riches have been brought to shelter. There's no question of our collaborating with the Muscovite proletariat. Well, I looked up the in the German version, and the word for exterminated is ausgerottet. Instead of, we usually hear ausrotten and ausrotten, but this is ausgerottet because it's a different tense, you know. Must be exterminated. Muss ausgerottet. So there again is that word ausgerott or ausrotten being used for extermination, translated that way by Cameron and Stevens. And he says, Moscow as the seat of education, Moscow as the center of the doctrine, but it's also translated as Moscow as the seat of education will disappear from the earth. You know, this is where he's saying that Moscow, and you brought that up to me, I had missed this, that Moscow, he's saying Moscow has to be gotten rid of because it's the center of Bolshevism. And it's the center of where they educate, where that education is going on. It's the center of the doctrine. And but he also cares about it. And this is not venality either. He says, as soon as its riches have been brought to shelter, they're not going to bomb and destroy, you know, not going to destroy all the culture. He's always so big on culture and all the art and so on that what Moscow had. They're going to bring it all to shelter. So this is not something that was going to be happening immediately. This was another long-range plan that Moscow would have to disappear. So he uses that word. To disappear from the earth is erdboden verschwinden. So, and then he also then says on July 15th that Stalin is one of history's most remarkable figures. And he often praises Stalin after a certain point, you know, as he starts to realize that Stalin is, well, although this is early, they just invaded in June, and on July 15th, he's already saying Stalin is one of history's most remarkable figures. In the regions we occupy in the Ukraine, the population is crowding into the churches. That's okay as long as there are no priests. That was referring to that the Ukrainians, they took away all the priests and sent them into the gulag if they didn't kill them, the Russians, the Bolsheviks, and then the people couldn't, they didn't allow them to go to church. they closed the churches, but the Germans came and they opened them. And he said, oh, they're just crowding into the churches, but they don't have any priests. And he says, he was saying that that was good because he doesn't know whether he wants a priest to come back or not, because people in the community were carrying out the function of the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't mind that. But again, is that there's a suspicion about priests, you know, and what they're up to. They're usually up to being revolutionaries against the revolutionaries. So, and then he says, he brings up Pan-Slav activity. He says he's been reading a report about the Russian opposition thinks it can use the clergy as a base of departure for Pan-Slav activities. See, that's another reason why he didn't like the Slavic priests. He didn't want them to come back necessarily or to be active. He was very much against Pan-Slavism, but of course he was for Pan-Germanism. So but that's, you know, the way it goes. But he saw Pan-Slavism as a real threat and didn't want the Slavs to organize in a large way because he didn't see them as a part of what he was building. He didn't see them. And there's a big differential about that today. And this brings up a lot of anger. I know that, but I'm going into it anyway. For what he said, he said the Czechs are the people who will be most upset by the decline of Bolshevism, for it's they who have always looked with secret hope towards Mother Russia. This was in September 41, and he says, in comparison with Russia, even Poland looked like a civilized country. When the soldiers went into Russia, they found, the Russian troops had all dispersed, and they had left things in a pretty bad way, and they had even had that scorched earth policy. But we said that the German troops, were just pretty shocked at what a primitive place Russia was as they were getting into the interior, and he said even Poland looked civilized compared to them, so that was kind of a smart statement. But you know, he does make this comment that on November 12th, that the masses in Russia, or he says in the East, can do the work. He says we in Europe are, he means Western Europe, are highly civilized people. We have to do all this manual work for ourselves. But he says here on the other side, in the East, we have all these, what he calls them, stupid masses, but, you know, they should be performing these tasks for us, and we can have them do that. And when they are working for us, they will be better fed than they have ever been hitherto and will also receive the household utensils they need. So he's talking again about, he said, Stalin pretends to have been the herald of the Bolshevik Revolution. In actual fact, he identifies himself with the Russia of the Tsars, and he has merely resurrected their tradition of Pan-Slavism. So again, he brings up this Pan-Slavism and sees Stalin as being the one who will put that together. And he says Bolshevism is only a disguise for him. He didn't think that he was that sold on that. What he really wanted was just power like the Tsars had. And he says, if we hadn't seized power in 1933, meaning himself, you know, the wave of the Huns would have broken over our heads. All Europe would have been affected, for Germany would have been powerless to stop it. Nobody suspected it, but we were on the verge of catastrophe. And that's all of the war preparations that the Russians had been making that they had learned about by, this was dated 5th, 6th January 1942, that they knew what was in store. And that's true. And this, there's recently been another argument about this, that Carlos Porter came forth and set the record straight. And I agree with him. He's right about that. That what the Russians had in mind, what the Soviets had in mind for the Germans and for Europe. Well, he talks now a lot about the Czechs. He's very familiar with the Czechs, and he says every Czech is a born nationalist who naturally relates everything to his own point of view. One must make no mistake about him. The more he curbs himself, the more dangerous he is. Of all the Slavs, the Czech is the most dangerous because he's a worker. He has a sense of discipline. He's orderly. He's more of a Mongol than a Slav. To put it briefly, the Czechs are a foreign body in the midst of the German community. There's no room both for them and for us. So these are some of the attitudes. Then he says, okay, this is a long one, April 5th, 1942. He says, let's avoid attempting the Germanization of our vital space on too great a scale. Let's be cautious, especially with the Czechs and the Poles. According to Himmler, history proves that the Poles have their nationality tattooed on their bodies. They must therefore be kept under control by giving them the strongest possible stiffening of German officers and NCOs and by trying to have them outnumbered by the German elements. So they don't want to give them too much freedom because they feel that they will try to organize themselves again against the Germans. So this was the future that he was envisioning, no doubt about it. He says it's very important for the future that the Germans don't mingle with the Poles so that the new Germanic blood may not be transmitted to the Polish ruling class. So there you go, too. You know, he didn't want to give German blood to Slavic people, to their elites especially, because that would just strengthen them and make them, he thought, more intelligent. He doesn't trust the common Poles and Czechs, or maybe it's he doesn't trust the educated ones. But now I need to go to race and Jews, my last category, Ray.
Okay.
And, of course, it's very important, and we know, we really do know what he thought about it. So, well, first he says, Europe is not a geographic entity, it's a racial entity. I thought that was interesting to consider. And he says the first thing above all is to get rid of the Jew. But he was talking about Romania here. But this is still his idea for everywhere, that the first thing you have to do is to get rid of the Jew because the Jews are causing all the trouble. And he was real clear about that. And those who are clear about it today understand that. I don't know why anybody should find fault with Adolf Hitler for understanding that at that time when very few people did. And he says, from the rostrum of the Reichstag, I prophesied to Jewry that in the event of wars proving inevitable, the Jew would disappear from Europe. That race of criminals has on its conscience the 2 million dead of the First World War, and now already hundreds of thousands more. Let nobody tell me all the same that we can't park them in the marshy parts of Russia. And this was on October 25th, 1941. He's saying that we have to get rid of these Jews and we can park them in Russia. You know, we can send them to Russia. And that is what they were doing. That's where a whole lot of them went. But that's all covered over today. And he says, I'll just read the most important sentence here for number four. Once the conditions of the race's purity are established, it's of no importance whether a man is a native of one region rather than the other, whether he comes from Norway or from Austria. So he was saying that within 100 years or so from now, all the German elite will be a product of the SS, for only the SS practices racial selection. So he was going along with that. I guess he and Himmler had this understanding that they were producing in the SS the future elite of Germany, but this elite was being trained hard to see themselves as serving the German nation, and they had very strict rules for their behavior and so on. As you know, like they couldn't steal or do any of these kind of things or hit people that they didn't have any right to hit or go around harming other people. So that's why they gave them such strict rules in the SS. And they were expecting these to be the leaders of the future, and they were not supposed to. They're not going to be people who are going to take advantage and become corrupt, you might say. So all forms of corruption were outlawed and punished severely. And then he says that racial doctrine is camouflaged as religion. Oh, he's talking about the Jews. He says the Jew totally lacks any interest in things of the spirit. He has no feeling for art and no sensibility. The Jew has put a religious camouflage over his racial doctrine. We can live without the Jews, but they couldn't live without us. When the Europeans realize that, they'll all become simultaneously aware of the solidarity that binds them together. The Jew prevents this solidarity. He owes his livelihood to the fact that this solidarity does not exist. November 1941, November 5th. Now, this is really nice. You know, he's saying that without the Jews, Europeans will see that they are a solid, you know, that they have solidarity together. And it's the Jew that prevents them from seeing that. And that the Jew owes his livelihood to preventing that solidarity, for that solidarity to exist. So this
keeps them fighting among themselves.
Yeah. So this is very nice what he was saying there, being very inclusive of all Europeans. And then he's talking about German women marrying Jews. Well, this was kind of about how to deal with the Jews in Germany. They talked about the decent Jews, so-called in quotes, and the Jews in the Fourth Commandment, peculiarities of the Jewish Aryan half-caste. Anyway, he says, probably many Jews are not aware of the destructive power they represent. So he understands that they don't all see themselves, but he sees them all as having this same destructive power. He says, if I can accept a divine commandment, it's this one, thou shalt preserve the species. Now, I thought that was just great. So this is the kind of religious ideas that he has. Preserve the species.
Right.
Yeah, and he's primarily, as I said in the very beginning, primarily the racial idea is what he sees as most important, because nothing else can work without that. And then he says, the Jew must clear out of Europe. Otherwise, and here's where this word extermination is used, the Jew must clear out of Europe. Otherwise, no understanding will be possible between Europeans. Here's that same thing I just mentioned. It's the Jew who prevents everything. But if they refuse to go voluntarily, I see no other solution but extermination. And the German word used is Ausrottung, for extermination. And we know that, as Hanning Scott says, the better word translation for that is uprooting, or that extirpation. But getting rid of, but it's not murder as they want to make it out to be. So he thinks they have to go out, they have to leave Europe. Why should I look at a Jew through other eyes than if he were a Russian prisoner of war? He says, in the POW camps, many are dying. It's not my fault. I didn't want the war. Or the POW camps. Why did the Jew provoke this war, he asks. He's in a sense washing his hands of it, saying, I'm not at fault for all of this, but the Jew is preventing everything good between Europeans in Europe. He has to leave Europe. He has to be put outside of Europe. Let's see. He's talking about half-caste. This is interesting. Okay, this is long important. 1st of July, 1942. He says, this confirms the opinion. This is my last one, right? This confirms the opinion I have already expressed when speaking about the Englishman Crips, that all half-caste families, even if they have but a minute quantity of Jewish blood in their veins, produce regularly, generation by generation, at least one pure Jew. Remember when he was saying that? A warning of the menace that half-caste can be. Oh, that's a warning. That's a warning of why half-castes are a menace. He says, a complete assimilation of foreign blood is not possible. That's what he says. And the characteristics of the foreign race inevitably continue to reappear. Our people, therefore, is only harming itself if it accepts half-castes into the Wehrmacht and thus admits them to a position of equality with pure-blooded Germans. We cannot accept the responsibility of burdening our bloodstream with the addition of further foreign elements. Then he says, exceptions in favor of half-castes must therefore be reduced to a minimum. This is, as I said, July 1st, 42. Well, you know, it was in the Wehrmacht, not the SS. The Wehrmacht already had a lot of partial Jews and other racial mixes in it. And when they passed these laws, these officers and sometimes generals, they complained because they had men in their service who they said were doing a very good job, and they probably were. And they didn't want to get rid of them. So Hitler says, send in what you want, and I'll look at it. So Hitler most of the time approved these exceptions, you know, that they wanted. So they already had these soldiers there. And that made sense. But that was doesn't mean that that Hitler was approving. You can tell by what he says here of having a lot of foreign people fighting in the Wehrmacht. He obviously didn't want that. Well, like a lot of people are saying now, they say, "Oh well, we had all this, you know, mixed people fighting in the war." Well, by 1940, a lot of that was put together in 1944, and by then, you know, I guess they needed everything they could get. It didn't make much difference. You know, you could sort that out later. In the beginning, though, he was really trying to uphold all these racial rules as much as possible, and I think this passage shows that. So those are the things I wanted to bring up, Ray, that I think are controversial about Turtle Talk.
Sure. Well, you know, that's a good summation and certainly touched on so many things. And you think we ought to ask if there's any listeners wanting to call in and comment
on
the question?
Let's do. The phone number, the call-in number is 323-642-1206. And if you call in, you know, and then you can stay on the line afterward. And, yeah, we'd love to hear. I'm sorry, I forgot all about callers when I went on and on like that. I didn't know it would take so long. But we really would like to hear from some of you. If you want to make a comment or ask a question about this book and these things that I've brought up are mostly what people want to say something about. So we're ready to get your call. I hear some sound in the background. I don't suppose that's you, Ray.
You know, I live across the street from a huge hospital, and their helicopter landing pad is right across the street from me. And I have thought often of, you know, those are the things when they come in, they do make a noise. And so on nights that we have the show, I'm going to have to keep my windows closed. And my windows are closed, but you could still pick that up. That was a helicopter. It just landed
well,
there next
funny,
to the
you
hospital.
Know, the sounds are so different. It didn't sound anything like that. It sounded like you were, somebody was shoving something along a table or something. And I thought it might be, here's somebody who's called in and a new caller, but they've only got their listening, their headphones. Lit up. Not, their mic is not lit up. This is a 315 area code. Maybe they don't know that they have to click one, or I'm just going to click the mic here and bring them online. Hi there, caller.
Hello?
Yes, hi, caller.
Hello?
You're on the air with me.
Oh, very good. I just wanted to thank you both for such a wonderful series. It's been tremendous. And it's a wonderful resource. And earlier in the show, when you were discussing the question of the authenticity, it just came to my mind that Hitler was such a tremendously eloquent speaker from his earliest days that it's just natural that they would have recorded the things that he said. They'd been with him for many years, and they would have realized that the things he said would be appreciated in the future, and so it's a natural thing that they would have recorded these. But I thought everything you said was on target, and again, thank you so much. I'll try and get a donation in one of these days, but it's been a real joy.
Well, hold on
a
minute, if you don't mind holding on for a minute. I'd like to go into this just a little bit, because then you might want to say something more about it. I think it was Bormann who had the idea of recording them, but it was probably mentioned by a number of people. And I do know of a story by Hermann Giesler. It must have been in 42, I suppose. Well, he stayed over. He was visiting with Hitler, and he stayed over for the first time for one of these, one of these dinners in the Führerbunker with the whole group. And Hitler was going on and on about something, and he was so impressed. Of course, he had talked to Hitler a lot on his own, but he says he whispered to Bormann, he said, "This is just great stuff. It should be recorded for the future."
Yeah.
And Bormann said to him, I've already been working on that. That's what Bormann said to him. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people, as you said, had that idea. Do you want to say anything, Ray?
I want to thank that gentleman for his kind words and his excellent observation. about the table talk and that Hitler's eloquence and those words needed to be put down for posterity. But I really appreciate the kind comments, and I thank you for calling in.
And not at all. Again, the thanks is all from the public, and I hope you get some support. It's been tremendous, and thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Well, we're glad you liked it. Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, isn't that... I know that there's many, many people like him who have truly enjoyed this series, and I hope we'll get a couple more calling in yet. So we're here, ladies and gentlemen. No, we just got your friend from Houston. If he wants to say anything, he's welcome to do so, but he doesn't have to. But I could see the system is different now because the mic is not lighting up, just the listening. And if he's there and he wants to say something, I have to click on the mic. So I think I'll go ahead and do that and just see if he wants to.
Okay.
If he doesn't, he doesn't have to say a word. Okay.
Right.
Hello there, listener. Did you want to say anything?
Yes, I do. I'm a lady rather than a man, but I felt like that during the time that y'all were reading all these, when Ray was reading it before, I got to be there and listen to some of it, and it was very good and very informative, and I just really appreciate y'all doing all this. It was very, very good.
Well, thank you very much. It's so nice to hear from a woman.
Yeah.
I just assumed that you were a man. So,
and I wasn't going to say any different because I wanted to surprise you, Carolyn.
Well, she did. What a nice southern accent.
Well, so, I appreciate you listening tonight, and you know, glad to have you as part of the audience, and I know you've heard some of this before too, and appreciate your interest.
Yeah, very
much. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you. And if anybody else wants to call in, she's just staying on the line now and listening
okay.
to the rest of the show. So let's see if we get anyone else who wants to call in. And if you, you know, it'll be afterwards people will write comments and say, oh, this and that. But they don't want, I would like it if they'd call in,
mm-hmm.
even if they want to complain about anything that I've said. Or any of the things that Hitler said that I read. But in the meantime, Ray, do you have any comment on, you can add anything to these controversial topics, or would you just rather go on to some other topic that we didn't have covered yet?
Well, I guess kind of on the last thing he said there, but it's totally about National Socialism, and it was the next to the last page of the book, it was like the principles of National Socialism in financing and the money part of running a nation. And he made those points about financing these huge, it says hundreds of thousands of marks for the construction of a road. And certainly that so many roads were built and environmental improvements had to be financed some way. And Hitler had come up with the way to do that without borrowing from the world bankers, if you want to call them that, and indebting his country. As he said here, this way, their way of financing a project is foolish in the extreme. The life of this road in question would be some 15 years, but the amortization of the loan, the capital involved, would continue for 80 years. So he applied National Socialist principles to that, where a nation has control of its own money. They don't have to pay interest to these outside people. And in essence, Carolyn, that is the root of why National Socialism and Adolf Hitler's Germany had to be thoroughly, thoroughly destroyed, because he committed the ultimate sin of breaking away and putting the money supply of Germany back in the hands of the German nation and taking it away from the Jew. And he hit the Jew where it hurts the Jew the worst, and that's in the pocketbook. And so that's, to me, one of the primary selling points of National Socialism, is that your nation is not in a debt, eternal debt. Your individuals are not in eternal debt. You buy a house for a 30-year loan, and you pay 30 years on something that should be paid in maybe 10, but then if you sell a house after 25 years, the person that buys it from you, they're going to be paying 30 years on that same house. So it's kind of a scam and a con game, and National Socialism broke up that monopoly. And,
well, let me give the phone number one more time, Ray, and then you can continue.
Yeah.
It's, ladies and gentlemen, it's 323-642-1206. 323-642-1206. You know, what you're saying here brings to my mind something I was thinking about since Monday night, and that is that, you know, you generally think in terms of the economics, National Socialist economics and so on, as the number one most important thing about Hitler and National Socialism. And having Scott does that too, he'll say, well, it's, you know, it's the economic system, and it'll go on and on. And I think, well, I realize that's very important. I still think the issue of race is the number one thing.
I'm in
agreement
with you,
and that's why
that,
I guess I find quotes like I do and say, well, he said this,
yeah,
you know. I mean, we all find.
You know, you
we,
and I are.
Yeah,
yeah, we're on the same page on that. There's no doubt about it. What I bring up the economic part of it because the economic platform of National Socialism was what made the rest of the nations gang up on and destroy them. They could have put up with the anti-Christian or non-Christian attitude. They could have put up with the racial supremacy, if you want to call it
that.
How
about the anti-Jewishness, though? How about that?
Well, the biggest act of anti-Jewishness was taking control of the mark, of their own, the Reichsbank becoming in control of it and taking it out of their hands. So, you know, that's just kind of, you know, the way I think about it. That's why it's very important to me to point that out because, you know, they might have left him alone, but you're right. Anything like reducing the number of Jews in the universities or in the field of medicine and things like this and newspaper owning and such as this, yeah, that would have made them mad as hell too, and it was, and that's another reason for the vindictiveness against the German civilians and prisoners of war after the war. That vindictiveness, that hate to the German people because Germany tried to take back control of its institutions and its money supply.
Well, right. So that everything is actually dealing with the Jews, and everything hurts the Jews. So the whole economic system hits the Jews, but also, as I brought up on Monday, all the various sources, I found there's some more of them that I discovered from Nicholas Kohlestrom's book, where the Jews said from 1933 through 1939 and then into 1940, from a lot of sources, that they were at war with Germany. And it was a holy war, and they were not going to allow the Germans to become a powerful nation again. They were not going to allow the Germans to become an important nation in Europe. They were at war with the German people, and all of this kind of thing, very, very nasty. So, and they said, this is, you know, all Jews everywhere are involved in this, and we're not fighting in the war, but we're coming right behind you. We're supporting Britain, and we know how the Jewish elites control, how much they control Britain. And so the Jews were against Hitler right from the start. Of course, they knew that he was doing his economic program started even before 1933, because he was talking about it and he was studying with people and he was announcing it and so on. So everybody knew what he had in mind. You know, I guess they had to build it up and they had to allow the war to get started, and then they had to just keep working at it until they could get enough, until they could get probably the United States into the war and wear down Germany over a period of time. It all fits in there together, I guess, because the whole racial problem is mainly the Jews, and the whole economic problem is mainly
right.
the Jews. So it's all
That's
the same
correct.
Thing.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And it's so hard, and just boring, too, when you just say, well, it's all about the Jews. You know, it gets kind of boring, and people would like to hear something else. But it always comes down to that, and that's one thing that Hitler understood so well. So few understood that as well as he did. And you know, that's another place where he was just so sharp.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good point. It all comes down to the Jews, because the turmoil in this country, you know, like in the 1950s when they those people founded the John Birch Society, and it started to be filled up with concerned citizens, a lot of conservatives and all, because of the seemingly communistic leanings and such as this going on in the government. And these people wanted to form an organization of patriots and get something done. And one of their brightest members was the late Revelo P. Oliver, a brilliant man, wrote many, many articles and all. And he was a wonderful speaker, and so they were going to let him speak for the organization. And at his talk, he started saying, you got to look and see who's behind the driving force here behind getting rid of Joseph McCarthy, Admiral Forrestal, whatever. And they are Jews. Oh, my goodness. They jerked him aside and said, never again will you mention anything like that. We don't do that. That's hatred of the poor Jews who've gone through the Holocaust. And they told him, you can't speak for us anymore if you dare say anything about the Jews. And their little public a publication, American Opinion, I think it was called, never, ever linked the Jews to any of these things going on, Castro in Cuba, things like this. And so what you just said, it basically boils down to the people behind the scenes, no matter how you cut it, if you want to get to the root of the problem, that's where you go. And as you say, Hitler was smart enough to know that and educated his people to it. So you can't be
even then,
anti-communist.
You know, he couldn't keep them from destroying him. You know, it's just amazing when, from this story, what you're saying here, Ray, that these Jews can be so powerful in this world, and it seems as though you know, they really are, and there's no equal power to them. Hitler tried to make another power against them, and all the other whites didn't cooperate with him. All the other Europeans and Eastern Europeans, Western Europeans, I don't care, Americans, Australians, all of them, they wouldn't, because they're all were too controlled. It was only Germany that had freed itself from that. But it makes you come to the conclusion that that there's no way to do anything about it. It's impossible. Yeah. You know, so many people have criticisms of Adolf Hitler, so much of it from white guys say, well, but, you know, Hitler was foolish to think that he could beat the Jews like that. I mean, he took on the Jews too much, and look what they did to him. Now we could have had some, maybe we could have made some headway if we went about it slowly, but the way Hitler did it, well, now we've gone backwards in time. You know, we're at such a disadvantage we can never get anywhere. They blame Hitler for that. Well, if he could, you know, if they've got that much power, I don't care how slowly you take it. You're not going to get anywhere. They're just going to undo everything you do as you go along. And that's what they're doing. So this is a tremendous question. And like you say, you know, it's so taboo. It's so taboo. And as many people as bravely come out and write this or that, we think, well, it's time, you know, it's going to happen. This will turn the tide. No, it doesn't.
Because
they've got too much power. I hate to be so pessimistic.
No, that's
Hitler wasn't
being
pessimistic.
Accurate.
See, he was an optimist, and he did everything he could.
Well, about 5 years ago, Mark Glenn and maybe two or three other people organized the No More Wars for Israel conference to be held in Orange County, California.
Right.
And I was asked to be one of the speakers, as was Frederick Tobin. And other people, and this was going to be a really, really nice conference, and we flew out there, and the Jews did their best to sabotage it. The Marriott, who was going to host our conference, all of a sudden came to us and said, no, you people can't meet here. We don't want your kind around. And so they shut down our conference initially, but Mark, bless his heart, he found a Greek Orthodox church that was willing to allow us to use the auditorium. you know, we had our conference, but a lot of our people were told when they checked in that it was over. Nobody was, you know, it was been canceled. And Mike Piper, are you there?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, okay. Michael Collins Piper has written the most definitive book on the Kennedy assassination to ever be written. And in it, he documents the involvement of the Israeli Mossad in the killing of JFK.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike would be asked to speak around the country about his book. And they shut down many of the university appointments that he had, saying, we don't want a person like that talking at this university, because there were Jews on the board of directors, or there were Jews who contributed, and we'll pull our if you have this guy there. So that's the power that they exert. American people don't believe that. You tell them, hey, those people shut down your conferences and everything. If it's something they don't want out, they will economically and arm twist and everything else and get it shut down.
Well, we don't want that stuff either. We don't like that.
Yeah.
We're against that.
Yeah, that's right. So,
yeah, that's how
at any rate.
Well, I wish somebody had an answer to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when
people,
you start talking about it, you just end up down in a hole because there's really nowhere to go.
Yeah, right. Well, I had my little phone here starting to bip at me like it needs charging.
Okay.
But I wanted to personally sign off with a short quote from the book.
Okay.
And it's simple but profound. Hitler says on the 23rd of March, 1944, midday, one of my greatest delights has always been to picnic quietly somewhere on the roadside. It was not always easy, for our column of cars would often be pursued by a crowd of motorists eager to see their Führer off duty. And we had to employ all sorts of ruses to shake off these friendly and well-meaning pursuers. And he says, on one occasion I remember a family out gathering mushrooms came suddenly upon our picnic party, and in a few moments these kindly folk had alerted the neighboring village, and the whole population was surging towards us, filling the air with their shouts of Heil. Now, does that an example for a police state mad dictator? No. That was the love of the people for their Führer. And it is simple but profound. And Hitler even deflected that, Carolyn. Remember, he said, these people weren't yelling for me as a person. They were cheering for the leader of the state. It was the office that these people were cheering for, and not for me as a man. It was what I stood for. I was the German state. So, anyway, I wanted to end my part of it on that, and I appreciate being a part of this project. You know, maybe we'll do it again someday.
Well, Ray, I appreciate you so much, and I thank you so much for the great contribution you made and your absolutely superb reading voice. You have a great voice, and it's good that you had the opportunity. You could use it here for this project, and I've enjoyed every bit of it. I'm going to miss the music. So I think it's time to play the outro music. We also want to thank our listeners over all this over a year's time that have been faithfully listening, and I know they've enjoyed it. And so we've now tackled something that nobody else has really tackled and has been a very controversial type of subject, the Hitler's Table Talk, and I think we've added quite a bit of understanding to it, and we'll see what happens from here. We'll see what, you know, how much it's still talked about, and if their minds have been changed at all. So thanks to everyone,
exactly,
listeners and you and I and everybody involved here, and we are now going to close out on Hitler's Table Talk with our outro music. That's it for tonight. That's it for this series. Good night.
Thank you, folks, and all the best from me, too. Good night.